KALW.
Part of what we have too much of is death and dying and our heartbreaking mortal experience being a private matter.
People are getting on stage to share stories of loss and mortality.
What we desire more of is healing through connectedness and reminders that we're not alone.
We're putting the spotlight on the final act of life. Then we're going to Golden Gate Park to celebrate its 150th anniversary.
You know, there's a reason they don't make greenhouses out of wood anymore. But it's totally worth it.
And we'll find out why it can be so hard to get around the Bay Area using public transit.
Well, I think the problem that you're getting at is they don't work as one system.
I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Death can be one of the hardest topics to talk about. The words, "you're going to die," may strike fear in the hearts of many people, but they state a simple fact that we can't deny, one that we oftentimes hide from. But in Oakland, death is taking center stage, in the spotlight, and stepping out in front of the curtain. People are creatively addressing death and mortality through storytelling, prose, poetry, and music. KALW's Joanne Marr reports.
My mother, her eyes were filled with tears and terror. She said, "I think Daddy's gone. I think he's not breathing."
An audience of 50 people listen with rapt attention as Eleanor Clement Glass tells the story of her dying father.
I went to him and put my fingers on his neck. I think you're right, Mom. I can't feel a pulse. And then I saw her knees buckle and I grabbed her and we stumbled onto the bed. And she took his hand and she kissed it and she held it to her cheek and I held her. And we just lay there sobbing.
Eleanor is a storyteller with Stagebridge in downtown Oakland, the nation's oldest and most renowned theater company of older adults. The company started back in 1978 with a mission to enrich the lives of seniors through the performing arts. Today's show is a first for Stagebridge. It's called For Dying Out Loud. Eleanor and three other seniors share their stories on mortality and coping with the deaths of their parents and friends.
These were stories that probably everybody has, but they don't have anyone to talk about it with. And we wanted to create a venue where we could share our stories and then hopefully spark discussion and thinking and feeling about living fully and dying.
And I run up to him and I grab him. I say, "Ron, Ron!" And he looks up and he has a blank stare. And I hear this sound come from him.
Ben Tucker, known on stage as Brother Ben, is another Stagebridge storyteller. Brother Ben is tall, with an imposing stage presence. He tells them about Ron, his good friend who died of a sudden heart attack while hiking in Berkeley's Tilden Park. In honor of Ron, Brother Ben and his friends installed a plaque on one of the park benches.
And it says, Ronald V. Nelson, date of birth, date of death, and it says, "Riding off in the sunset." Happy trails. Happy trails to you
until we meet again.
It was cathartic. I felt some emotions. I thought I had all the emotions out, but I did get emotional. But it helped me bring out that last little bit of grief and share it with the audience. And I could see the looks on their faces. And Ron was in the room. And I think he would have been very proud that he was being remembered in such a supportive group of people.
But not everyone is comfortable discussing death, let alone on stage in front of strangers. Many of us fear death, or we're in denial about the end of life. Some psychologists say accepting our own mortality can help us embrace life and live our lives more passionately.
Hi, everybody. Hi. Welcome to You're Going to Die, Poetry, Prose, and Everything Goes.
For the last 10 years, Ned Buskirk has hosted You're Going to Die at the Lost Church, an intimate theater in the Mission. The monthly event is an open mic featuring storytellers, poets, and musicians. Ned casually gets on stage wearing a t-shirt and baseball cap.
At the count of three, just everybody say, I'm going to die together. One, two, three.
I'm going to die.
Part of what we have too much of is death and dying and our heartbreaking mortal experience being a private matter. And I think what we desire more of is healing through connectedness and reminders that we're not alone.
All right, you guys in the bar, quiet down now. We're gonna do it. Yeah, let's give it up for each other.
I leave the show and I feel more alive and connected than I did before it began. And I think maybe if I could argue anything happens at the shows, it's at least that. You feel less alone and more alive.
Let's see, Steven, you ready?
Yeah.
Get up for Steven.
You're Going to Die started in Ned's apartment with a few of his friends after his mother passed away in 2003. It quickly grew and now draws a sellout crowd of at least 70 people, most of them in their 20s and 30s. The event attracts people from all walks of life, artists, doctors, and professionals.
A warrior feels her imminent death, senses it more intensely. Because she puts her body on the line, she risks her mind too, not knowing if her soul is invincible.
It's hard to say what brings everybody to You're Going to Die. It could be that someone's just lost someone and they meet a friend who says, you should go to this. It really helped me after my dad died or my friend died or after my breakup. And then I think other people come because what a fascinating thing to see people bear their deepest parts of themselves.
My biggest thought has been, I don't want this to be happening over and over again. That's all I think. And then at parties and social gatherings, talking to people about whatever and whatever, when all that's going at my head is, we're all going to die. We're all going to die.
I went through an experience not unlike that. You know, a death of the soul, a death of the heart, a death of this identity, this life that I had pieced together.
I'm really missing my dad this time of year. He has not died. He's just in Hawaii with his girlfriend.
You're Going to Die runs the gamut of emotions, from joy and ecstasy to grief and sadness. Performers can easily move Ned to cry one moment and laugh the next.
I mean, it's how it was when my mom died. You know, these long stretches of feeling just destroyed by sadness and despair and heartbreak and suddenly finding euphoria or a moment of hilarity. There's something healthy about that.
The evening is winding down, but when the curtain closes tonight, the show isn't over for Ned Buskirk. You're Going to Die is also a nonprofit that does charitable work. This allows Ned to give center stage to local musicians who perform for hospice patients. And his prison program is an expressive outlet for grieving men at San Quentin. Ned's use of the creative arts has touched many people in the Bay Area and has helped normalize open discussions around death, the final act in our lives.
We're all gonna die. But look at us. Good night.
For Cross Currents, I'm Joanne Marr.
That was KELW's Joanne Marr. Support for that story came from the Gerontological Society of America, Journalists Network on Generations, and the Silver Century Foundation. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hena Baba. This year marks the 150th anniversary of Golden Gate Park. There's a lot happening in celebration of this iconic San Francisco landmark. Like, just this week, the park doubled the number of bison in their herd. And the city's installing a 150-foot Ferris wheel set to open on April 4th. Plus, we are launching a podcast. We'll be visiting some of our favorite attractions, taking you through the park from east to west. Are you ready? This is the debut of the Golden Gate Parkcast. We're here at the eastern edge of Golden Gate Park. To our left is Mount Sutro, to our right, Lone Mountain. We're leaving the busy streets of the city and entering San Francisco's urban sanctuary. Let's walk in. This is the Golden Gate Park cast from KALW. It's a journey to and through many of the park's greatest attractions. I'm your tour guide, Hena Baba. And some of the sites may be familiar.
Yes, it's just a good time to get outside. Over here, you can just throw the ball around.
Some are hidden gems.
Now this time, pretend you're trying to hit that sign over there.
Okay.
And you got a paintbrush in this hand, and I got to flick it and go whomp and get the paint over there. Okay, now go. Flick that paintbrush. Best cast yet.
All of them are to be found here in this 1,000-acre greenbelt through one of the world's great cities. Ready? Let's go. Strolling down John F. Kennedy Drive, we're passed by all kinds of vehicles. Cars, for sure, but also bikes. Lots of bikes. Skateboarders, Segways. The landscape goes from urban gray outside the park to lush green with grass and trees. Up ahead on the right, there it is. A long and tall building is in the back of a lawn filled with flower gardens. Its white walls stand out in the middle of all the greenery. This 250-foot-long building, made of wood and glass, is one of the most elaborate structures in the park. And it's clear to see that this historic landmark is nearly as old as the park itself. True Quint takes us inside.
Golden Gate Park's Conservatory of Flowers is San Francisco's very own Victorian greenhouse. Lo Hodges, Director of Operations and Exhibitions, says it's more than a building. She thinks of it like a person who's lived a long life.
She's a one-of-a-kind because, well, the rest have basically fallen down. You know, there's a reason they don't make greenhouses out of wood anymore. But it's totally worth it.
Hodges loves her work.
No, I have the absolute best job in the world. Half of my job is getting to work with the coolest group of horticulturalists on the planet to come up with fun, whimsical, wacky ways, basically to teach little kids and big kids about plants.
As the director, Hodges oversees exhibits ranging from recreated Jurassic landscapes to historical moments in San Francisco. Hodges says this type of prefabricated greenhouse is rare. The structure is like Victorian IKEA.
Somebody back in the day picked her out of a catalog, and she was sent to them in crates, and you sort of had it set up.
In this case, that somebody was James Lick.
And I know for, like, California listeners out there, for sure, they can probably think of at least one thing named after him. Lick Observatory, there's a school, there's freeways. And he was just wealthy as all get out.
But Lick passed away before he could get the greenhouse built, and a group of other rich San Franciscans, Leland Stanford and Charles Crocker included, bought the kit. It was then donated to the city and opened to the public in 1879. It's delighted San Franciscans ever since.
Right now we're in the Highland Tropics, so this is the cool room.
Nursery specialist Mario Vega has cared for the conservatory's plants for over 8 years. The Highland Tropics Gallery is meant to mimic the climate of cloud forests you'd find in the mountains of South America, somewhere like Machu Picchu in Peru.
Well, one of the unique things about this room is the collection of cool-growing orchids. For instance, the Draculas, which are right here in front of us.
Vega says the name has nothing to do with blood-sucking monsters. It's about dragons.
If you look into the flower, you can kind of see a face. And it was thought to resemble a dragon. And it also has the hinged lip that moves about in the wind, and that attracts pollinators.
That gets a particular fly incredibly excited, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A
mm-hmm.
flower is really just a fancy way of attracting a mate to get laid.
After ogling Dracula orchids, Vega and Hodges continue into the aquatics gallery.
We are now going from somewhere above 3,000 feet in altitude to sea level.
A huge concrete pond takes up most of the space. The air in here is more humid. It's warm and sticky. Carnivorous pitcher plants hang like vines while they lure bugs for lunch. Some of the larger pitcher plants, though, can catch bigger meals.
And these are even bigger.
Yeah, they're purported to catch small rodents.
Despite the flesh-eating plants, this room is calming. You can get a sense of what it might be like to sit next to a trickling creek in the rainforest. While Vega and his team work to maintain the gallery's tropical climates, forests outside the conservatory are on their own. Rainforests once covered 14% of the earth, but that number is down to 6%. This living museum is meant to bring people and plants together. Lo Hodges says if she can get city kids to have one connection to plants, she's done her job.
So great ones are looking at the cacao tree or the chocolate. I mean, again, most little kids, you think of chocolate, you unwrap it. It comes in a bar, right? It's a sugary thing that you think of and you get at the 7-Eleven, whatnot. But showing kids the plant it comes from, and I say kids, big kids, little kids, but hopefully visitors, you know, they go home and the next time they're eating chocolate, it clicks.
It clicks for Hodges and Vega too, even though they worked here for years. They still take in the delights just like kids. Hodges reaches out and rips a piece of bark off a tree.
Smell that cinnamon.
Oh, it smells really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me about it?
Yeah, it makes me want to make cookies.
This work, Vega says, is his dream job.
Well, I remember coming here as a young kid and then through my teens and always thinking, you know, that this was the gold standard for tropical horticulture.
Vega and his colleagues are working to maintain that gold standard, so the next generation of the coolest group of horticulturalists on the planet has a place to belong.
That story was produced by Truk Nguyen. Next time on the Golden Gate Park cast, we're going to head out of the Conservatory of Flowers, across its front lawn, and through a tunnel under the road. We'll discover a scene you won't find on any map, but a park tradition nonetheless.
We used to call this the Conservatory of Flowers, and we used to call this the Conservatory of Music.
Find out where we're headed next time on the Golden Gate Park cast. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Next up is Hey Area, where we find answers to questions you ask. This one came from out of state, from New York, where they do things a little differently. Adam and Sarah wanted to know, why does the Bay Area have so many transit systems? KALW's Precious Green took to the streets to find out.
New York City is home to more than 8 million people. And they rely on one major public transit system, the MTA, to get around. Compare that to the Bay Area, and things get a little more complicated. The Bay is home to just over 7 million people across 9 counties and more than 24. That's right, more than 24 different public transit systems. So, Adam, we can understand why you wanted Hay Area to look into this. I head to Ariel Fleischer's office south of Market. She's the transportation director at SPUR, a research nonprofit that promotes good governance and planning in the Bay Area.
I would say the root cause of all of these is that California makes it very easy for a variety of reasons for local communities to create their own transit systems, basically through the way transportation is funded.
This wasn't always the case. Public transit used to be funded solely through local bond measures. That's how what became Muni was started in 1912. The Alameda Contra Costa Transit District, better known as AC Transit, started service the same way in 1960. And then came BART. By mid-century, the region had a growing congestion problem. It wasn't about this town or that, it was all around the Bay. And that's what inspired the rail line, one of the first to be funded with local, state, and federal money. So for a time, there were just three large operators in the Bay Area. Then, in 1971, California enacted the Transportation Development Act, or TDA, and that changed everything.
My name is Ian Griffiths. I am the policy director for a nonprofit called Seamless Bay Area.
So what exactly is the TDA?
A quarter-cent gas tax that became one of the primary sources of funding for transit. And it essentially said any part of the Bay Area can begin collecting this tax and create their own transit agency.
Now, any municipality, no matter the size, could raise money for transit. Before long, the Bay was home to County Connection, Petaluma Transit, SamTrans, VTA, Tri-Delta Transit, WestCat, and so on. This created a patchwork of operators.
Well, I think the problem that you're getting at is they don't work as one system.
And what does this mean for most riders? In a word, frustration. Users face a complex mix of different fare structures, confusing schedules, and routes that just don't match up.
For new or non-regular riders, it really presents a high barrier to transit use. And the result is fewer trips taken by transit and also less trust that transit is a practical option.
What's crazy is that there is an agency responsible for planning and coordinating transportation in the Bay Area. It's the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, or MTC. But
in reality, in its 50 years of existence, MTC has not been very successful at promoting very much coordination.
So there may be a regional vision, but MTC has no real power to enforce it. Why? Well, Adam, that's a long story. And a whole other Hay Area question. Stuck on a bus somewhere between East Oakland and Lake Merritt, I'm Precious Green for Hay Area.
Precious is a fellow in KALW's Audio Academy. You can find more stories from our fellows at kalw.org. And we're actually accepting applications for our summer training program. Find all the details at our website. Tune in Monday at 5. What does it take to run a trans-inclusive business in Oakland?
I feel like if I'm going to survive as a business, then I have to still be me, and who I am is like still gonna be providing for people as much as I can.
There's a new kind of restaurant in the town, Monday at 5 on Cross Currents. And before we leave, here's some local music. This is Bob Thayer from San Francisco. He's performing at The Right Spot this Saturday night.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Julia Linus Goodman, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Victor Tense. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.